Turn this back on. Yeah, excuse me. Hopefully my voice will last all of today, but with the sinuses all plugged and I can't hear anything, but I'll just keep talking away expecting you to hear. Talking about the last lesson on the qualifications of the elders, overseers. This is actually the fifth part, which I didn't. I did part six last week, and then coming back to part five because I had evidently erased it. So I redid it, and I have it back up on the website. So you can go to the website, and you'll find this one as it is today. Other than this morning's lesson, actually picked up a couple we didn't get to last week because of time, but you'll find all of them on there again. We'll have one more next week about the likewise wives or women, that part of it, and then so in going through this, we're looking at the qualities that elders and overseers need to possess, looking at all the qualities given in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. And obviously the first qualification, as we've mentioned each time, is that the man must aspire to the office. He has to be willing and voluntarily do it. This is something that he himself can only decide. None of us can tell him to or force him to. And so this qualification is his choice. Secondly, though, we've been looking at, I listed all the qualities given in these. And so we're looking at the not given to wine, not violent, not quarrelsome, quick-tempered, gentle, not greedy for money, not covetous. And then the last two there, not a novice and has a good testimony from those outside. Now, especially in this list today, there's a number of them. If you have like New American Standard, you'll find some of these aren't there. And you have a difference between the King James and New King James versus New American Standards. And there's a few of them that get left out. Okay. And why they get left out in the New American Standard is an issue of textual, the oldest texts and things. That's kind of a whole lesson up to itself, how the people have gone about collecting the Bibles and how they have determined, well, this verse may not be there and those things. And that's kind of a whole study to itself. Takes a while to understand the thinking on that. If you're ever curious about that, feel free to ask me. I can explain it to you if you have a little while. But not for today's class. But anyways, I'm taking all of them that the King James or New King James would list. So you'll notice a couple of them not there if you have a New American Standard with you. But we're going to look at those this morning and fairly quickly. Not given to wine actually is not. And then one the word here pertaining to one who is given to drinking too much wine, addicted to wine in some translations, drunken, not getting drunk. Now, I think in this case, when you're looking at not given to wine, I think it really, I consider the advice of Proverbs 31, especially when dealing with elders, because Proverbs 31, the advice for King Lemuel is, it's not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. The reason that they were never to be intoxicated is because they were leaders and they were charged with and responsible for always being prepared to deal with any situation that would come up. Well, elders ultimately are really in the same position, that they can't be somebody who falls into this trap, because you're looking to them for leadership and guidance, and you know that leadership and guidance can be called upon 24 hours, a day and 7 days a week. And so they have to, I think it really applies to leaderships in the same way. But I think we need to really expand it from the New Testament times when it talks about not being given to wine or not being addicted to intoxicating drink or getting drunk. We have to expand that to all the drugs that get people intoxicated. We ought to take this principle to things that are both legal and illegal drugs. For example, I have a last congregation I was at, there was a woman there who, the amount of painkillers she took would kill most of us. And she'd been taking them for a long time that way. And she had a doctor who supposedly was treating her for pain because of back pain and knee pain and different things. But in fact, she was getting pain pills from multiple doctors. And she was taking even more than the pain doctor, the special pain doctor, was supposedly giving her. She was hooked. And every little ache that occurred in her body was another reason to take pain medication. Now, you're looking at it, she showed up on Sunday all the time. You know, and I went over her house a number of times and helped pick her up off the floor when she was essentially out of it. But she was hooked. Now she got hooked in the most, benign of ways. I mean, she took pain medications for legitimate reasons initially, and then got addicted to them, enslaved to them. And so even if you would say, well, she really needs to be on that much medication, and occasionally she just may fall into that. Well, if you were to take a man who is in a situation of in so much pain that he had to take so much medication that he was essentially enslaved to them and would at times be out of it, you're essentially eliminating him from being qualified to do this job. Man is ingenious at coming up with substances that enslave the hearts of men. As God said before he destroyed man, most of men at the flood, he said men's imagination is towards evil. And we just keep kind of coming up with more ways to take things that are by themselves good. If we take most illegal drugs, most illegal drugs have even come from good plants, the cocoa plant, and where cocaine came from. It actually derives from drugs we use to numb, and we take it, and what we do is we just keep boiling it down until it gets stronger and stronger and stronger to the point that it enslaves the hearts of people. And essentially that's what crack is. It's so strong. It's cocaine that has become so strong that it enslaves people quicker than most illegal drugs. But really, legal drugs could do the same thing. There may be a reason to first have taken one, but if you come enslaved to it, you're falling into the trap of becoming given to drunkenness, intoxication. It comes from not just alcohol today. It comes, and in fact, I would suggest to you, even in alcohol, from what I've read, I'm no expert, but from what I have read and from other supposed experts have said, that alcohol content of 2,000 years ago was at most 6%. That the natural fermentation process maxes out at that. We actually have the alcohol that all exists today. Generally, most wine is about 12% or so, and that's because we don't just ferment it; we actually distill it partly as well. And all the other alcohols that are higher than that are all distilled as well. They burn off everything and leave the alcohol behind, so the alcohol percentage goes higher. Our ability to get drunk on alcohol is takes a lot less of it than it did 2,000 years ago. And even the most common way to drink alcohol 2,000 years ago was even to mix their alcohol with water, so that they were drinking things that were like 3% and 4% alcohol, which is a third of what I took last night in NyQuil, which has 10% alcohol as I read on the label. But so we have to be understanding these things. He was warning them at a time when you took a lot more to get drunk than it would today. And they also had the situation of they fermented much of their grape juice because partly they couldn't stop it completely, but it also, without refrigeration and different things, it allowed drinks to be preserve them. So it was preservative as well. But today we have none of those reasons. And so when you're talking about these things that cause us to get drunk or intoxicated, we really need to steer away from them. The strength of them has become so strong for us that these are things that all of us really need to be careful of, even in medicine, which you find biblically is the one place where alcohol or intoxication is specifically given positive statements is in medicinal purposes. We find it used in the Proverbs that way, as well as the passage in 2 Timothy about use a little wine for the stomach's sake. Gets debated whether or not the phrase there actually refers to something alcohol or not. But if it does, still he's taking it for a infirmary, for some sickness he has. So anyway, have to not be given to wine or intoxicating substances. Cannot become enslaved to those things. Now, not violent. This really means not being a pugnacious person, which really means hitting. This isn't argumentative. This word doesn't mean argumentative. This word means hitting. People who don't hit. Being bullying and hitting others. It's a word referencing physical violence, hitting, fighting, brawling. I think it's very appropriate that it follows not given to wine, which tends to lead people towards that path, or at least some. But there are some who are physically violent people because of their own temper and lack of self-control, regardless of substances that might take away their inhibitions. Now, the other, not quarrelsome or not quick-tempered, not quarrelsome is translated peaceable in, I think, New American Standard. In King James and New King James translates it not quarrelsome, but it's actually a single word. It doesn't use the word not something. It actually does use a single word, meaning to be peaceable. But Strong says it's not to be withstood or invincible, it's not contentious, and it's to abstain from fighting. But the fighting is not just physical fighting in this case we're talking about. Someone who is quarrelsome or not peaceable is striving or struggling with others, starting arguments and things. Being contentious is kind of the idea in terms of quarrelsome. To be peaceable is somebody who's not contentious, who's not argumentative, who's not always, you know, picking even verbal fights, whether or not they would go to physical violence or not. Not quick-tempered, which is similar, and this one is not quick-tempered. The idea here is to be inclined to anger. Okay, real quick to anger. And the temper rises up and flares quickly. Quick-tempered persons lose no time being angry, do so with those who ought not, or do so with those they ought not, over things they ought not, and far more than they ought. Statement from Bauer's lexicon there. And so, basically just hot, we would call it hot-tempered. So you don't want to have somebody who's hot-tempered, whose, you know, temper just flares quickly. Now, gentle means not insisting on every right or letter of law or custom. Yielding, gentle, kind, courteous, tolerant. Definition there from Bauer's lexicon. You know, I see people who, in our society in America, we often see people who insist on rights. I have the right to do whatever I want to do. I have, you know, we get kids sometimes who reach 18 and says, "You can't stop me. I have the right to do what I want." And, well, yeah, that's right. You know, you may have the right. You may have a legal, you know, legal system behind you. Doesn't make it the right thing necessarily to do all the time. But a gentle person doesn't insist on having their rights all the time. I can do whatever I want. That's not gentleness, in this, as they're talking about. That's not somebody who yields. That's somebody who's tolerant and who's courteous of others. That's somebody who's selfish, you know, who's all about themselves. And so this idea of gentleness, you know, of being willing to give in to others. In James 3, verse 17, it says, "The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable." A little different peaceable than the one we, different word here for peaceable than the one we just looked at. But it is gentle. So it's pure and peaceable and gentle. Willing to yield. You can actually see this even coming here, the idea. Willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. So God's wisdom is willing to yield. Even God's wisdom, which is absolutely pure and absolutely right, is still willing to yield. And so it's an attitude and an attribute that all of us as Christians really need to have within ourselves. Not insisting upon our way all the time. Now, Philippians 4, 5, another place where we see this word used, "Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand." Another, again, passage just telling all Christians, this is an attitude and an attribute that all of us need, that we need to be gentle people, that we need, and it needs to show. It needs to be known to all that we are willing to give in, that we don't have to have our way, that we are courteous and we're tolerant of others, and we're yielding, we're kind, all of those things. This gentleness is what we're talking about. Lord is with us. We don't need, to everything to be our way. Not greedy for money. Now, this is the one where you don't get all of them necessarily in both of these cases. We have not greedy for money and not covetous. And New American Standard doesn't include both of them. But it means not, and then using a word that means eager for base or sordid gain. So I think the Old King James says not greedy for filthy lucre. Okay, using the idea of not wanting to get money, in a bad way, essentially. Now, excuse me. In 1 Timothy 6, 9 and 10, it says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." 1 Timothy 6:17 says, "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy." So, the idea of not greedy for money here is the greed has not overtaken them so that they're willing to do anything to get money. We see that that's exactly what overtook, what's his name? My mind just seems so blank. The apostle that kills himself. Yes. I'm having trouble keeping my mind straight this morning. But so when Judas had that exact problem. He was willing to steal for money. His greed overtook his, it wasn't just I want money, and he was willing to do anything legal to get it. He actually turned to illegal means to even get it. Okay, so that's where his greed had taken him. Now, not covetous has really the same idea, and in fact, is translated, I believe, in New American Standard, of not loving money, or not even maybe not greedy for money. But the previous term had to do with the method, the being filthy lucre, sordid and base gain of doing illegal things to get money, stealing, doing whatever. This term has more to do with the love of it itself. Not so much with that you're willing to do anything to get it, but you've got to be careful of not loving it. You can't love money. Okay? And this fault is as likely in poor as it is in the rich, who, often those who don't have steal because they want money. We're talking about the love of money itself, not money. Money's not the problem. It's the love of the money that's the problem. In Hebrews 13 and verse 5, this word's used here, it says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." So you see that there, how he's using the word, that you don't covet things, you don't love money, because you're content with what you have, because God has told you, I won't ever leave you or forsake you. So you're not worried about having to have a lot of money, or you're not worried about, situations or things that might come up, because you know God's with you. You know God will take care of you. You know he would never leave you. And so you're content with whatever situation you have. You don't need more. Whatever you had, it's like, the problem is, and you think about this problem, no matter how much somebody has, it's I need more. I want more. Okay? There is not an amount that exists that somebody couldn't say, I want more. There's no rich amount That if a person loved money, it says, that's enough now. Doesn't happen. You know, say most of us would think to the people who have millions and or billions of dollars, you go, well, how could they could never spend all that. I'll bet if you ask them, they think they could spend it all. There are things you could spend billions of dollars on. Some of them, you know, none of us would ever do it, I'm sure, or we can't even imagine it. They could. I bet you they can. And they don't even have access to actually most of it. Can't even spend most of it. But the problem is, whatever we have, the attitude is, I need more. I want more. That's what we've got to be not have. That love of the money, the love of wealth. Not a novice. This is very pretty simple. Novice literally means newly planted. This word is only used in Christian literature in this figurative way. Outside of the Christian literature, it's never used this way. It means of things you newly plant. In Christian literature, though, it means of new converts. Okay, somebody who has become a Christian. Now, the reason he can't be a novice is because lest he become puffed up or conceited and fall to the devil. And he is telling us that a new convert is more susceptible to being puffed up about himself, thinking he has done something great in and of himself, and therefore susceptible to falling into the devil's hands. What's going to happen to the church if this happens? The question of not a novice is, what is the period of time for a novice? I think there's a judgment here. I don't know that there's a set time. Because for some, it may be longer than for others. Because some may learn very quickly and grow into maturity very quickly, and others may grow into maturity over a much longer time. I don't know that you could say that. We find new converts, you say, well, how about a year? Somebody's been a Christian a year. So that seems too short, right? But we go back into the book of Acts, and we find upon Paul's first missionary journey as he went around, and he started churches, and then he came back and appointed elders. I don't know how long transposed between those, but more than a year seems kind of a stretch. But why might somebody in those churches have been ready to be elders within a year? Well, most of them, a lot of those places were started from the synagogues, from Jews who had already learned God's wisdom, who already had been being taught and being trained in, you know, God's truth and understanding, and now they were just learning, you know, the last part of it. So they were now receiving the Christ and the Messiah. So they may have already been prepared most of their lives. But then we go to places like where we find in the New Testament the churches where they're predominantly Greeks and Gentiles. We actually don't find any of those churches ever referencing, or at least not quickly, referencing any elders. You know, Corinth never seems to have any elders referenced to about it. And obviously had lots of problems. So it may have taken a Gentile who had been raised up in idolatry much longer time to have overcome, you know, being a new novice than it would have a Jew who had already been trained in the Word of God. So it's kind of hard to say, but if you take this idea of he's not new, along with all the other passages of able to teach, knows the Word, and all has that maturity in the Word of God, you know, I think we'll get a better idea. So, it may also be, you know, but we may look at this, you know, it's just that judgment that says, well, what's new? And I remember when I became a Christian, and there was a gentleman there in a congregation I was at, and I guess I was there for about a year or so, and I was brand new. I mean, I just didn't know anything about the Bible. But I studied a lot. I studied probably daily, and I read the Bible in that first year, read the Bible through a number of times. And I was having study at his house one time. We were having kind of a, you know, just some home studies in his house, and he was talking to me and another friend of mine, the two of us, had kind of become Christians at the same time, and he was telling us how we had affected him. And this is a guy who was, I think we were like our early 20s, and he was 40s, early 40s, been a Christian for 20-some years. And he felt like in a year's time, we knew the Bible better than he did. And he had been going to church for 20 years. And he felt ashamed. And it really spurred him to actually begin to grow in ways he had not been doing. And so in his knowledge, he was really very much a babe. I mean, he really, even though in his age, he was getting to the age of being ready to be an elder. Of course, all the other qualities might have been lacking too, but he hadn't grown. And so he really was much more like a babe or a novice than he was a mature Christian. So it can depend. Now, and he really repented of that, really realized that. It took some young people coming in who made a real diligent effort to study to show him how much he had not been doing, how little he had really been considering and reading and studying the Word of God. That can happen. That could happen to us. That could happen to all of us. You know, we look at somebody else and go, boy, you know, they're setting a good example. I need to do that as well. Now, excuse me. The last one here, a good testimony from outsiders. I find this one really difficult to apply. Today versus when I think of 2,000 years ago, and I think of a city. If I'm in a city, and it could have been difficult even in a city, some of the larger cities like Corinth, you know, Rome. But if I was thinking, if I'm living in most of the cities that are in the area around the Mesopotamia, or you know, in around Roman Empire, you got fairly small towns. People all work there. You work with all your neighbors. You don't travel far. I mean, you're walking to and you know everybody in town. The towns are fairly small. There's not hundreds of thousands of people in most cities. In fact, the very largest cities generally only had hundreds of thousands of people. But even those hundreds of thousands of people were often in very tight quarters. And now most of us, though, if we thought about our lives now, the outsiders that know most of us, I would suggest to us that a lot of times the church, we don't know the outsiders you know. Because the outsiders that most of you know are probably people you work with. And I've probably never met anybody that many of you work with. And so this is a tough one, I think. This is a tough one to figure out. And how to go about, you know, does this person have a good testimony from those outside? Do people who are not Christians think highly of this person as well? Now, the purpose is that he might not fall into the devil's trap of reviling, which means an act of disparagement that results in disgrace, reproach, reviling, disgrace, or insult. So that he's not disgraced or insulted. From somebody outside looks at him and goes, this is a guy who leads your church? It's like, wow, could you get in a worse person? I mean, if the outsiders were saying that, that would be bad. That would be a very big stain upon, you know, the body. But if the leaders of our congregation were behaving so that the disgrace would come upon him, what would it also mean for the congregation's reputation? But we also have to remember this. In 1 Peter 3:15 and 17, it says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. Now, notice in this passage, Peter's referring to people being reviled, as mentioned here in Timothy. But he's mentioning they're reviled, but they're being reviled for good behavior in Christ. What if an outsider said, you know, I really don't like him, because, you know, he's always preaching Jesus. He's always telling everybody they ought to follow him. And he says, I don't like him because of it. Now, is that a bad testimony? No, it's not. It wouldn't be to us. That would be a good testimony from an outsider. Even though they didn't like the person because of it, it would be good behavior in Christ. And therefore, it would not, you know, But if the person from outside was saying, boy, you know, person's kind of, it's not really that honest. I see him taking stuff, you know, from work and stealing things. And, you know, that would be a bad testimony. Suffering for those things they do wrong. A testimony for things they're doing wrong, I think, is really the idea here. That those outside need to have thought of this person. Now, the difficulty I have is, how do we test this one? if we have a few men who were suggested, and none of us necessarily knows any outsider who doesn't think highly of them, how do we test it? How do we go about doing this? Do we just say, well, as long as nobody comes to us, but how would they know to come to us? How do we test this one? That's the difficulty, and I don't have a good answer for you, by the way. If you've got a good suggestion, or if you've been in a congregation where somebody had a good suggestion, you know, feel free, let me know too. I'd like to know, because I think this is tough. As I think the differences in societies and the different ways we live, because you think about almost everybody here, where you work and where you live are so far apart, you would not be able to be in those two different places if you had to walk to work. That would not be a place you could go work if you had to walk. Because we in their day, you had to work and live essentially in the same place. You couldn't have spent half your day walking to a place to go to a job and then half the day to come walk back. So you have to, your jobs and your living quarters have to be right there together. And so you're going to be living with all the people you're working with too. And so your entire community is going to be intertwined in the way they work and communicate with each other. And yet we live in a society where people have a lot more communication with somebody in another world over an internet blog or some than we might have to our neighbor who lives next door to us who we can't remember their first name. And so I don't know how to overcome that real well. But I do think it's something that has to be overcome to some degree to make sure that this person does not have a bad reputation from those outside. And because that's really what we're talking about. A bad reputation for things that are wrong. Not necessarily being a bad reputation for being, you know, a Christian or being doing the things that Christ would want us to do. So, okay. Well, we're going to stop there. Next week we'll have the last one. I hope you're all thinking about men who you think might be qualified, or if they aren't right now, at least maybe in the near future. And I hope you're talking with them. I hope you are going to them and you're mentioning to them, do you think they either might be or are close to being? Maybe you have questions about other things you don't know about them. But I think it's important for all of us to be thinking about this. And why I'm coming back to this regularly is that all of us continue to think about it. We continue to think about the men, and the men themselves continue to think about it themselves and decide whether they aspire to it. And if they do aspire to it, then they've got to prepare themselves and plan to get to overcome if they have deficiencies. If they have things that they're not good at, and they look at the list and go, well, you know, that's something I'm really kind of weak at, then they've got to make some decisions about, I need to overcome that. I need to get better at that. I need to grow. You know, and they've got to work at that. And they might need help. But all of us, needs all of us working together in this. It needs all of us encouraging men to do this. You know, if we're considering any man, one of the difficulty sometimes is if men were considered, people can begin to pick on them. But, you know, it's like, well, you know, I don't think they're good. I don't think that, you know, this isn't good. They're not fitting that category. That, and so it can become a real negative thing. But let's remember that if we're considering somebody at all, the person already has a pretty good standing and reputation as a Christian, if we're considering them at all. And so if they're not completely having fit, that's not a real negative thing. If they're not all of this stuff we're looking at, that's not all of a sudden they're terrible. You know, they're not, because a lot of men are not, a lot of men will never be all of these things. And so if any man is put forward, we need to give consideration to them. We need to give And we may decide, well, maybe they're not qualified yet. Maybe they're not fitting all this. But that's not a terrible thing. That doesn't make them horrible. And we have to be careful of making sure we don't turn it into some attack or negative thing upon anybody who might be mentioned as a possibility, but whom we don't think is qualified just yet. That's not a blight on their name. That actually is saying something good about them, that we might consider them, that they're close. That's a good thing. So we need to be careful. We need to be diligent about this. We need to all consider it, but we need to be careful that we don't turn it into something negative and we attack anybody. But we do need to try and help men and encourage men, and hopefully the men themselves will aspire to this very good work, this necessary thing that is helpful to the church here. If you're here today, though, and you're in need of the gospel in any way, if we can help you in studying today, if we can baptize you into Christ, if we can offer you the invitation of God to come to Him and, you know, to confess that you know that Jesus is the Lord and Christ and sits at the right hand of God, then we'd be glad to hear that confession, to baptize you. If you're here today and we can serve you in any way, if there's something that you need, please don't hesitate to ask us if we can help. Please come forward and let us know so together we stand and sing.